everybody. Thanks for listening to the RacerX podcast show. Just a quick reminder that you can email me at mathes@racerxonline.com, M-A-T-T-H-E-S, and I'll do my best to respond to you. Check me out on Twitter at PulpMX, as well as check out PulpMX.com for some cool stuff that I think you might like. But anyways, on to the show.
This is a warning. Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. What are you going to do about it anyway? You won't have a head. You've been warned. And now, welcome to the Racer X Podcast Show with Steve Mathes.
Across, and you're listening to the Racer X podcast with Steve Mathes.
Thank you for calling Fox. How may I help you?
Hi there. Can I speak to Jeff Fro Emig?
One moment.
Hello.
Fro Daddy.
Hey, are we on again?
We are.
Part two.
Part two. It's like a movie sequel. Well, thanks for being on the Racer X podcast show once again. I appreciate you doing this part two. We left off. It was getting dark, Fro.
I don't see this as... hopefully this isn't like the Godfather saga where part two is, twice as long and gets really weird and... everything, so...
Yeah, no,
but
no.
But there might be some flashbacks in here.
Yeah, yeah, like Star Wars was upbeat, you know, that the Rebels were good, and everyone won at the end. Empire Strikes Back, Han got frozen. A lot of bad shit happened in Empire Strikes Back. This might be the Empire Strikes Back of Jeff Emig's career.
Yeah.
If you follow that at all.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, 97. You dominate the Nationals, you win the Supercross, you dominate the Nationals... You wear black, all black shift gear in the hottest days, which was just awesome to see. You weren't scared. So at the end of 97, like you said, you had no goals. Everything was done. You'd won almost every title there was to win, except for 125 Supercross. And so is that where kind of things started getting unhinged at the end of 97?
Yeah, for sure. Like I stated at the end of part one, is that... You know, I had reached all my goals, and and that was really as far ahead as I looked. And I mean, when I look back now, that really was a problem. Is I didn't reset everything and focus. I was just coasting, using the momentum of the last couple of years on into Supercross. And to be honest with you, coming into Supercross in 2008. I was just as fast as what I had ever been. I was as strong as I had ever been. I was ready to go win again.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to ask you about that, because you were doing good in the off season, and you look good at some of the races. But man, there were rumors that you flew in some F-14 jets and you had some equilibrium problems. Your eyesight was I mean, there's all these rumors. You know how
things
go.
There was some weird stuff going on. I can't tell you really. There's no definitive evidence that, but after I flew in that military jet,
really?
I don't know. I mean, it's not like I'm going to make an excuse for it.
No, no, no. But you're being serious?
Hard.
Really? Yeah.
It was just hard to just get focused. Hell, it could have been, the lifestyle that I was leading. Who knows? I'm not going to like blame it on something. The bottom line is that coming into the first race, I had no doubt in my mind that I was going to win it. I actually led. At the LA Coliseum.
Yeah.
And I had, and actually when Tortelli passed me, he came from like 19th to first.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that he was a lapper. And I'm like, I'm not even worried about this guy.
Yeah.
Because I thought he was down.
Yeah.
And hell, he ends up winning the race. And I was really pissed, you know. And the next week, we went to Houston. And I got a third. And then it was like, all of a sudden, like the lug nuts, dude, are just breaking off. And it was maybe the third or fourth race of the season. We're in Seattle. I hole shot of the main, got a 14th. I never fell.
And, yeah, you faded. Yeah, I remember.
I just was mentally, that's when it all unraveled right then, yeah.
Wow.
And then it went downhill fast. I mean, I'm the only Supercross champion in the history of the sport that has failed to win an event after winning the championship. So that's the crown that definitely right up there, one of my records.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, wow, really? Is that me? Oh, I'm that guy?
Yeah,
oh,
no, you you didn't even make the top 10 in the points the next year. So
yeah.
What was it? Was it confidence? Was it partying? I mean, looking back, what made you suck that year, Fro?
I wasn't driven. I didn't have a goal.
Okay.
I wasn't focused. And then about the time that Daytona came around, mm-hmm. I was really looking forward to it because I think that I had a way to win Daytona,
mm-hmm.
That people didn't look at it from this viewpoint. And I came into Daytona just really on fire. You know, it was starting to warm up again. I was looking forward to the Outdoor Nationals.
Yeah.
In the heat race, I won my heat race, and I planned on winning the main event. Maybe I battled with MC in my heat race, something like that.
People forget, too, Daytona back then was gnarly, rough, outdoorish Daytona. I mean, it was...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was fully prepared for it. Really had a good vibe going, like I'm going to be able to, to actually win this event.
Mm-hmm.
And then I injured my back, in between my shoulder blades.
Mm-hmm.
I strained the ligaments. And in between the heat race and the main event, I mean, my neck and my back and my shoulders and everything just completely locked up on me. And it was something that I dealt with for a month or so after that.
Eventually,
why I bowed out of the series.
You don't know what you did to do it? Just a crack?
Yeah. I strained the ligaments around my spine.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely happened in the heat race.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I did a lot of therapy and stuff to get back just before the Nationals, mm-hmm. where I was doing like these, therapy, like where they...
Put the little jackhammer thing on you or something?
Into your ligaments and all that. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was pretty painful and just a really bad time. And then that time off really wasn't good, you know.
yeah.
I didn't use it as wisely as I should have.
Right. Did you re-sign after 97, or were you still under contract? How did the money work?
No, I had signed a two-year deal, yeah.
Okay, so 98, yeah. You were in your last year of your deal?
No, 98, 99.
Oh, after 97, so... What's going on there at Fox Racing?
No, they're partying in here. It's birthday time for somebody.
Is Beaker there?
Yep.
Tell Beaker I said hi.
Yeah, but he's working.
Oh, yeah, of course. So not at the end of 97, man, your 98, 99 contracts, you killed it. I mean, that had to have been the most financially rewarding for you with the most amount of money coming in and then some time off. Maybe didn't help.
Yeah, for sure. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we had the contract was solid, was happy with bonuses and the money that I was making and all that. And, things were all pretty good, but mm-hmm. there really were, things were really unraveling in my personal life. You know, I was just spending a lot more time out at night than I was, really focusing. And this is where the, burning the candle at both ends, where it started to take its toll, you know. And in 98, I came back and won a few of the Nationals.
Yeah.
And then I injured my thumb at Millville.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions, was what would have happened? You were on fire. You were catching, I believe, Dowd? Who were you catching? Henry? Henry.
Yeah.
You were catching Henry big time, on fire. The old Fro was back. It came out of nowhere at Redbud, where you went 1-1. What would have happened if you hadn't hurt your thumb? You might have won that title and a whole lot of things. things could have changed.
Yeah, I think I would have closed in on the points, but I don't think that you could have counted on some sort of thing happening again like it did in 92 and 96, where I was going to pick up.
Were you that far back?
It was about 40 points or 30 points down. Yeah.
Okay.
I was just worried about winning all of the races and, mm-hmm. and proving that in the second half of the season that I was the fastest guy. But, I still, it probably would have just delayed the inevitable, really,
right.
With what was going on personally.
Too many nights at Club Rubber, as Denny would tell us.
Yeah, it just seemed like it was just hard to get out of that mode, And
right.
Just a lot of things pulling me in the wrong direction. No matter how, how I tried to make the right decisions, I kept making the wrong decisions. So,
let me ask you this: at the height of everything, how bad was it between you and MC? I mean, I know there was stuff like some girl stuff off the track, and there was a lot of rumors and things going on. I mean, did you guys ever like had a big dislike of each other? I mean, did it get pretty gnarly?
Sure. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, nothing that wasn't civil. That if we, seen each other, it was, it's not like we're going to start a big brawl between the two mm-hmm. of us. But yeah, I mean, it certainly at times has been worse than others. But
yeah.
We're actually we're on pretty good terms right now. So
right.
I have a lot of respect for him and what he's done. And a lot of respect for who he is. He has, reciprocated that. And, so, yeah, we're all good.
Funny how that works years later, huh? Like when you guys are all done and you're out of the deal and all that. Jeremy's one of the coolest guys around, as is you. And, why wouldn't you be friends? You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the competition thing is tough,
Right.
And
you guys are
just... I mean, it's odd because a guy like Doug Henry or John Dowd or somebody, had a tremendous amount of, respect for them also and just seemed to get along with them better. And it wasn't like our battles were, like they were any different.
Mm-hmm.
It's just with me and MC, we're both here on the West Coast, kind of on our, on each other's turf. But,
yeah.
All of
yeah.
our friends have always been really close, and we go enjoy the same activities and things like that, and we're all good. But, with the competition and stuff, the way that it was, there's just always a little friction there. Thankfully now that we're, both yeah. nearing 40, all that's starting to dissipate, and it's all cool,
Yeah, for sure. No, it's good to see. So, you seem like a rider that when your confidence is there, you're unbeatable, but it's like a teeter-totter. It's really close to
oh,
losing
yeah.
the confidence, and then your results would plummet. You agree with that? Was it just...
Oh, totally.
Yeah, like you
that's
were just...
That's what it's all about is confidence, and that's
just,
why,
yeah.
That's why MC just kicked my ass in the beginning of Supercross. I
mm-hmm.
just really had a hard time building my confidence. And Supercross is all about confidence. You're leaning over the front of the bike. You're, everything seems pretty risky, gnarly jumps and rhythm sections and all that. And the guys that excel in Supercross have a lot of confidence in themselves. And even if they have a bad day, they still believe that they can win. And that's how I was in motocross.
Mm-hmm.
But in Supercross, it was a real struggle for me.
I just think about, your 98 season where you were struggling. You come out at Red Bud. And you go 1-1 at one of your favorite tracks or the favorite track that you have, and nobody could stop you. Your confidence was back, and that was it. You know what I mean? It wasn't like you radically changed training or riding techniques. It just you knew you could win, and that was it. It was curtains for everybody else,
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that I feel real fortunate that I look back and, I feel that I have my destiny in my own hands,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think that every rider can honestly say that, but that if I got my shit together, that I feel that I could beat everybody
yeah.
any day.
That's a good point.
And, but it amounts to getting your act together. So.
Right. So, 99, Another miserable year. 99, actually, probably looking back on it from the outside, might have been your darkest year, yet your most fulfilling year. And the reason is you get fired from Kawasaki, and Bruce Sternstrom told me a hilarious story about that in the only way that Bruce can. You get fired from Kawasaki, but then you win the U.S. Open on out of a pickup truck, which was, you know,
a rented van.
Oh, a van. Okay, a rental van.
Clarify. Well, I had a tour bus and a rented van, yeah.
Which is still one of the coolest stories around, you know,
yeah.
As far as just being a privateer guy. Talk about 99 season for you. I mean, more personal life stuff going on and just more of the same sort of mediocre results for a guy like yourself, right?
Yeah, well, I'm still waiting for Hollywood to write the screenplay on that.
Yeah, I know. Huh?
On that situation. But, you know, for sure in 99 just was really making a lot of bad choices, trying to get it together. Just it wasn't working. It didn't help none any that the bike that we had, the 99 Cowie, we had a lot of chassis problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I think it really, really manifests itself in Supercross. The thing just was not right, you know. And it's things that happen. I mean, every company goes through it.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, you know, no company is immune to it. And as a race team, you're paid to ride that thing. You can't ride
right.
something else or whatever. And so we were going through a real transition with the KX250. It was a tough year.
Mm-hmm.
And Carmichael was a 250 Supercross guy, Damon Huffman, and myself. I mean, the only podium that we got in Supercross, I got a third at the Vegas round. That was the only podium of the year.
Yeah.
And then when we got to Glen Helen and we had to ride that bike at a much higher speed, then we figured, okay, well, something just isn't right here. And we struggled with it all. You know, we struggled with it all year long, and by the end of summer, we got an engine setting, I think, that was much better.
Mm-hmm.
We got the chassis figured out. And by then, you know, the whole Lake Havasu incident had gone on. And what I look back now, what's really disappointing is that there was some, with our engine spec, we had to take a few steps back to go forward, right?
Right.
That type of mentality. And the Lake Havasu thing happens, you know, on a Sunday morning. And on Tuesday, I believe it was, we went out to Carlsbad and we went testing.
Mm-hmm.
And we found what we needed. We found the missing link.
Yeah.
And I was really pumped. But everybody else, like even J-Bone, we didn't really talk about it. None
mm-hmm.
of the guys on the team talked about it while we were out testing. But everybody knew that, you know what had hit the fan.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, I'm just going on like business as usual. And then I decided to get in touch with the DA and all that stuff down in Lake Havasu and just try to expedite what's going on here, you know.
Yeah.
So met with the DA on a Friday, you know, which is only, you know, 5 days after the arrest. And on the way down, I got the call from Bruce Sernstrom that Cowie was going to let me go,
mm-hmm.
and that it was his choice, you know, his decision.
That must have been.
But it's not like there weren't. It's not like we had never had a meeting with my business manager Dave Stevenson and myself in Bruce's office, going, "Hey, look, you need to tone it down."
Yeah.
I mean, we had a couple of those meetings, you know, and I look back on it, and it's like the whole J-Law thing right now. I'm just going, wow, he doesn't see it either.
Yeah.
You're like,
hey, buddy, I've been there. I know it.
Yeah, I've been there. I've done that. And so, you know, I can empathize with that situation, but it was a tough call, man. I was with my buddy Tony Strangio, and I said that was Bruce.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, wow, not good. Nope. And so really what came after that was one of the toughest phone calls that you have to make is I had to call my dad and tell him what was going on, and he didn't know that anything had even happened.
Oh, okay. You didn't even tell him the first thing, yeah.
Not that not the proudest moment as a son, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Go on.
But my dad actually took it extremely well, and he's like, hey, you weren't happy riding that bike anyway, and obviously some changes have to be made, so mm-hmm. you need to get to it. And I'm like, hello? Hello, can I speak to Gary, please?
You're like, what happened to my dad?
Certainly didn't have that much understanding when I, was 12 years old and I...
You spilled the paint
at the wall or
something.
Yeah,
yeah. Bruce told me that when he gave you the news, and I thought he said that you were in an office, but I guess not. But
I was in the desert.
You kind of understood it. You didn't. You just went, yeah, yeah. Like it's almost as if you knew it was coming. He felt really bad about it. He told me he felt really bad about it. But you kind of knew it was coming.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean. Like I said, when I had been on the phone mm-hmm. With the DA down in Lake Havasu, and she's going, why are you wanting this to happen so quick?
Yeah.
And I said, look, lady.
Yeah.
What you're going to, any penalty or whatever mm-hmm. that you're going to give me is nothing compared to what's going to happen in my professional life.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's just get to it, okay?
Right.
And she's like, okay. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm probably going to lose my contract and all this other stuff, and this whole thing is going to, totally crash and burn. I said, let's just have an outcome here. Let's just finish this thing off, do what we got to do, so I can move on.
Right.
So.
Imagine if there was the internet back then. Oh man, the names Fro would have been called.
Yeah. Well, that was the beginning of it, so I think that's how everything happened so quick. But
yeah,
I missed a race. I remember speaking with Larry Brooks about possibly riding their bike in the last couple races. And, AMA wanted me to, of course, to take a drug test and all this, nonsense. And
mm-hmm.
But Tim Dixon still had my tour bus back east, and I said, "Hey, pull that thing into a Steel City. I'm gonna fly back, and I'm gonna show my face. Just kind of." It was really uncomfortable, because here I couldn't go to the Cowie truck. I walked past the truck, but I'm not on that team anymore. But I just made sure that I went there. I said, look, here I am. Hello. I'm not in jail. I'm not, how the rumor mill gets, and it's like all of a sudden, that everything gets to be bigger than what it is. So I just showed my face, and I said, okay.
Right.
Yep, I made a mistake. And what happened after that was, just a few weeks later, is when I really decided that I gotta make some changes here. I don't like the direction that I'm going.
Right. And so what made the Yamaha decision? Well, how'd that come about?
Excuse me?
How did the Yamaha decision come about? Like, let's get a Yamaha. Did they give you any support? How did that go?
Well, I had right away afterwards, I got together with Tony Strangio and mm-hmm. Tim Dixon, two of my best buddies, and, tried to reformulate a plan. And I had got on, I had tested the Primal Impulse Suzuki. Mike Rearing, offered up their team and bike and stuff if I needed it. He didn't really agree with me. I had a chance to ride, I think it was Brian McGavern or somebody, had a YZ250.
Uh-huh.
I rode it. We talked about it. Dixon's like, look, this bike is the best bike through the whoops. And if you want to be a Supercross champion again, you're going to have to figure it out because you are the worst guy through the whoops, okay? and if you want to win Supercross, you have to be the best guy. So we said, okay, let's get on the Yamaha. Tried to do a deal with Yamaha. Keith McCarty was not interested. Then he was interested. We decided to run everything through Jim Herkman and North mm-hmm. County Yamaha.
Yep.
Yamaha really didn't. They wanted to help me. We had had a great history together from back in the early '80s on mini bikes, and then of course in the early '90s. But I was just kind of taboo,
Right. Yeah.
Nobody really knew what I was going to do, and I'd got on that bike, and I still hadn't made the decision to really get things focused until after I went to the first round of the World Championship at
Rose Bowl
in Paris.
Yeah,
and I got a third that night,
uh-huh.
and I remember being on the podium and just like, man, this is like, this is the best night. And it was a soccer stadium, and I walked out onto the middle of the grass, and it's raining, right? You know, it'd been raining all day.
Yeah.
And I remember being in the middle of the soccer field, just looking up at the lights, and the rain's coming down, and, you know, people, you know, picking up the track and all this stuff. And I just felt at that moment, I just felt, okay, you gotta make some changes in your life, and you can do this again.
Mm-hmm.
You can be a Supercross champion. You can be a champion, but it's going to take some changes. And so then that next week, I decided to go into a drug and alcohol, a rehab. And,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the best decisions that I had ever made, because it's exactly what I needed to, mature at that level. I was still acting like an 18-year-old, you know.
You're not talking about rehab at the Hard Rock pool either.
I'm not talking about rehab at the Hard Rock, no.
Okay.
I've been there. That was part of the reason.
You went to rehab for the rehab pool.
We created the rehab.
Well, that's interesting. And actually, I didn't know that. I didn't know you actually went and sought help for it. So that's that's something I learned.
It's interesting when you go through a situation like that. You know, you kind of learn about who you are and what, you know, what drives you to make the decisions that you are. And I recommend it to everybody that is, you know, struggling with some sort of a decision like that, that don't be afraid to take the step and kind of, you know, dig up what's inside. And it's not like I had anything major. I just needed to get focused, and that's what I needed to do. And, I mean, I remember coming to, we went through the U.S. Open and all that stuff, but specifically when we came to the Rose Bowl, is we were doing the press conference, and I had won the U.S. Open at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it's the first time that I, during the press conference, you know, with everybody around, the writers sitting next to me, you know, all of us, it was the first time that I voiced it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, I think it takes a lot of balls to do that, you know, to not just keep that kind of hidden and, okay, well, that's a little my thing. As I said, no, I'm going to voice this. I'm going to tell everybody. And, I think as far as my competitors went, they, once again, if he's getting his act together, that's bad news.
Right, right, yeah.
You know what I mean? He's going to be, you know, some real competition.
Goes back to that confidence thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Fro's getting it back. So the off season comes, so off season of 99 comes out, and you're riding Yamaha, you're testing it. How do you feel at this point? Are you riding at the Yami Supercross track, or where are you practicing at?
Yeah, well, Ross Maeda did a at Enzo did a spec for the Fast Cross in Italy,
mm-hmm.
and then he did a spec for Supercross, and we never changed it.
Really?
No testing, nothing. We just that was the spec, and then we ran it. Because
mm-hmm.
I said, look, tell me what it needs to be, Ross. I trust you. Just make it what you think it needs to be, and then I'll ride it.
Yeah.
With the engine, we worked with Varner and with FMF. Buddy Morgan actually was helping out a bunch, and Dixon was building the bike.
Mm-hmm.
And we did extensive testing with the engine of making that thing get the whole shot. You want to win the U.S. Open, you got to get the whole shot. Right? That was the plan.
Yeah.
And so we did start after start after start, and dude, that's how I won the U.S. Open,
because mm-hmm.
I got the whole shot.
Right. And yeah, what a night that was.
Well, and that, once again, it comes back to the same testing that I did back on 80s, that I know what I want. I know how to start. Let's make the bike be the best that it can be out of the gate. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I got the whole shot both nights.
Right, right, yeah.
113 grand.
yeah, it's nice that you remember that. What happened? So you come back, you're looking good, and the rumors had it that, you know, you were super fast. I remember, again, I was still on the scene as a mechanic, and it was like, hey, Fro's riding really good, and he, you know, he's coming back, and you watch out, and then disaster strikes. You break both of your wrists or arms? Which was it? Both? What happened? What happened in the crash?
What's interesting is that fall was probably the best that I've ever ridden a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
Except most of the time, you know, not too many people got to see it. but especially November, December, after the World Championship ended, I had a good ride, but a horrible finish at the final round, and I was so pissed, and I was so motivated. So in December, I mean, I was just on fire, and we were putting the team together. We got a semi, you know, we got a sponsor. You know, like in Days of Thunder, it's like, we got ourselves a sponsor.
Got matched tires.
Yeah. And so Dixon and Strangio were doing what they needed to do. I was doing what I needed to do. And every day we'd be out at the Yamaha track, and we'd go out in my Ford four-wheel drive, and we got the bike.
Mm-hmm.
Not the test bike, not the race bike, just the bike. The only one we have.
Yeah.
No testing, no suspension testing, no engine. This is it. This bike's good enough to win on. And I remember specifically having a talk with Dixon and, you know, and also Tony. I said, look, you know, we're not going to beg Yamaha for parts. We're not going to beg them for works this, for factory that.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do the best I can on what we have. And I guarantee if I do that, then they're gonna offer us what we need.
Yeah.
Okay, so once again, it comes down to the mindset and the attitude. And every day we'd go out testing, you know, and I would match McGrath's time, whatever it was. Every day we just kept chipping away, and it was the best that I've ever gone through the whoops in my life.
Right.
It was all because of the attitude, you know. And I was really driven during that time. And it was, I mean, I feel real fortunate that I had the opportunity to go through those days, because I used to hate testing at this time of year.
Right.
But it all changed. The mindset changed, the attitude changed, and I just was chomping at the bit. And, I mean, you know, in my mind, I was going to go win Supercross Championship as a privateer.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, nobody had ever done that. So, yeah, I mean, it was motivating. It was exciting. The day that I got hurt out at Stefan Roncato's track, that was probably one of the best days that I've ever ridden a motorcycle.
Oh,
made
really?
A little mistake.
Yeah.
Made a little mistake and came up short on this little, this little triple thing, and pushed both my hands through and bent, you know, bent my hands back around my arms and snapped my wrist, both of them.
Jeez.
No bueno.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. What was the emotion after that? I want to quit or F this. I'm going to rehab and come back stronger. What was that like?
That's interesting that you asked that, because it was really emotional that, wait, all this is done now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here I'm forming this new team and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And that's over. I mean, you know, like that momentum has stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of had a feeling, you know, that, wow, I've accomplished what I need to. That maybe this is a sign, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Anaheim 1 with two broken arms and watched the main event, and I left the main event just going, dude, I can beat these guys. There's no way this is it.
Okay.
And so I rehabbed my wrist. It was the most painful rehab that I had been through in my life. You know, to this day, I have great wrists. You'd never know that I had the injuries that I did.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Matico did a great job on my wrist, and you know, got back on the bike again.
Interesting that you know it's almost like you said it was maybe a sign, but I'm trying to relate it to something that I know where like maybe some movie or something where a guy gets ready and sure he loses the championship battle, but he knows that he was there. You know what I mean? He put the work in and he was on his game, and you know, it goes one way or another, but he knows in his heart he's empty. He's done. You know what I mean? As far as he's come back from the abyss. So interesting. Yeah. I kind of put a parallel to that. If only I could remember that movie, but I can't.
What was interesting is that once I got back on the bike, Button had gotten hurt earlier that year. Yamaha was offered me the 426 at the time.
426, yeah.
They had offered me the factory bike, the factory ride, and I said,
really?
I'm gonna, I've got my team, and I have an obligation contract and stuff. So I went out, I tested the bike, and, you know, keep in mind, I'm still rehabbing, my wrist and stuff, but really impressed with the bike, and you know, it seemed like it was going to fit my riding style too. You know, that low end torque type of thing. I don't like to rev it. Like, wow, this is really exciting, and we're going to come back for the motocross championship.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to get a deal done with Yamaha. We couldn't make the numbers work. I wasn't willing to ride the bike for free.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted something out of it. I felt like I deserved something out of it. And then that, like they say, that fateful day, a few days later, I went out to Glen Helen.
Literally a few days later?
A little less than a week. Yeah. So I go out to Glen Helen. To do a little bit of testing for the first national,
mm-hmm.
and third lap, come up to that, you know, the old finish line jump, and
yeah, in front of the grandstand,
shut off the throttle, and it didn't shut off; it just kept going.
Jeez. So you bailed off of that, you fell off the back of that, and you break your back. Were you really? I remember reading that you couldn't feel your legs. Is that true, or at first, really?
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of laying on my right side, you know, if you can imagine, kind of face down, but yet on my right side, and right away knowing, wow, okay, something's wrong, you know, uh-huh. a lot of tightness in my back and my stomach and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Looking down, couldn't get my boots to move, you know, I couldn't move them.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it was 5 seconds, maybe it was 20 seconds. It seemed like, you know, eternity, but... I went through the whole thought process, I think I just got paralyzed.
Yeah, scary.
I mean, it was a lot more F words in there, but, and then I started feeling the pain from my right leg. I had compound fractured my right lower leg
mm-hmm.
at the same time, and I started feeling the pain. Okay, pain's good.
Yeah.
And then I moved both my legs and, you know, all of that kind of, you know, that state of shock that I was in went away. And right there, I just remember, I remember like it was yesterday, but I was looking at the dirt, like I was in the mud,
mm-hmm.
and I could see, like, every grain of sand, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, everything was so in focus. And right then, I just felt it, like, it's over.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah, really.
Just like that. It was like my racing spirit said, this is it. We're done.
Especially after all, like you said, the work you went through with your wrists, where it was incredibly intense and hard for you, and then that happens. Throttle stuck. YZ250. Not good.
Yeah.
So your team that year, soldiers on, or, you know, tried to soldier on without you, but... You ran into some funding issues, I guess. Some of your sponsors, maybe.
No, that was the year after Phil Lawrence came on board that year. Brian McGavern rode the Supercross. Had to let him go after that. At the end of the season, we brought Michael Byrne over from Australia, who Phil Lawrence recommended.
I was going to give you credit for Byrne, for discovering Byrne, but okay.
No, if I remember correctly, he even rode a Honda.
Yeah, he did.
He didn't even ride one of our bikes.
No, he rode a Honda.
And Phil had hurt his shoulder or something, and then the EdgeSports.com wanted to step it up. Kawasaki needed to fill a void in their racing program,
mm-hmm.
and it all came together with one of my other dreams was to be a team owner.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the transition from the racing's over, but let's keep racing.
Yeah. I don't want to gloss over your back and your leg injuries. I just wanted to hurry things along, but I imagine that was pretty pretty intense. Again, another recovery, another therapy, you know, that kind of deal.
The toughest thing was getting on a plane and making it out to Davey and Shannon Coombs' wedding, because
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really in the best shape to be up and about like that, but
yeah.
You know, Davey's like a brother to me, and so I soldiered through, and with the help of a few prescription medication, you know, painkillers, and and made it back to Morgantown.
I'm sure he appreciates it to this day.
Yeah, wouldn't miss it.
Yeah, exactly. So the team ran into funding issues that next year. That had to have been another blow to you to pack that thing up, but I admire that instead of packing it up, you were like, hey, Burner, You're doing well in the Supercross. I believe he was, you know, one of the top privateers, if not the top privateer. You're like, I'm taking to the races. And there you go. You guys were in a van, I think, for the last three or four. And I think that was really cool of you to do that.
Yeah, well, certainly wasn't the best business decision. And, Dave Stevenson, my business manager, said, hey, you need to shut the doors here. This thing's bleeding money.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the edgesports.com was about, you know, $700,000, $850,000behind in checks. So we spent everything that we had and a little more. So after all that was said and done, we really didn't make make any money.
Yeah.
And that was having a sponsor of about $750,000, I think, or maybe it was $1.5 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a significant amount. I'm sure there's plenty of teams out there this year that would love to have have those type of checks coming in, but that was the racer in me. It's like, I'm not going to leave these guys hanging out to dry. And unfortunately, Casey Johnson and I, we weren't getting along. His results weren't there. And I had to make the decision to let him go, but to support Michael Byrne. And it really came down to his effort and his attitude is why I decided to do that. Because I could have easily just said, hey, there's no money. We're all done.
Yep.
And I felt that Michael, that he deserved that opportunity, and so we got him got him away to the race. I think it was with Pedro Gonzalez and whatever team he was on, and probably cost me $30,000-$40,000
to make sure he was out
there. Out of my pocket for him to go race the end of the championship. But we got a top 10, we reached our goal, and that was totally worth it.
Yeah, no, it was cool. Like I said, I always thought that was. Because believe me, a lot of people in this industry would have just been like, see you later, Burner. Sorry, bud. You know what I mean? So it shows something. It says something about your character that you did that and you helped him out. And I mean, Burner and you are still incredibly tight, and I think you guys will always be friends. And I know he's told me before in one of these podcasts again that, you know, M.A. Fro took a chance on me, and I'll never be able to repay that to him. And you know what I mean? So greatly appreciated on his end, I think.
I love the guy. I mean, he's like a brother to me now. So
yeah. Segueing into the Motocross the Nations career that you had, one of the best ever runs, losing and winning, but you know, Jeff Emig was always there for the team no matter what. I want to see which was the worst Des Nations for you and which one was the best one for you, because you were on a couple of losing teams, but then a lot of winning teams too.
Yeah,
so.
I can tell you those weren't great. Losing the Motocross of Nations is a tough thing, because you feel like that you really let everybody down. Really, one of the toughest defeats of my career came with a 2-2 score.
And
toughest defeats of all, whether it was the Nations race or championship race or anything. Because in 94, we're in Roggenberg, Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I was the fastest 125 rider in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is that our bike just was not set up for a fast track like that.
Yeah.
Paul Malin was riding Michele Rinaldi's teams. I think it was Bobby Moore had won the world championship that year on the bike.
Yeah.
It was well suited for the track, and Malin, he rode awesome, dude.
Mm-hmm.
He was,
yeah,
he was hard to catch each moto, and I rode the best that I possibly could, and it wasn't good enough. And even though the other team riders didn't have, the days that they needed to, I took it upon myself that if I had won both my races and been the top 125, that we would have won the Chamberlain Trophy again. And so I just took it personal. And I felt like that I let everybody down. And it was a tough, after the awards ceremony, I think it was maybe Davey or like Eric Johnson or somebody had spotted me out like down the hill on this track. I was kind of overlooking this beautiful Swiss valley where the racetrack was. And it just got to me, dude. The emotions came out. And it was, it was a tough emotional moment. And I'm glad that I at least had some time alone right then to where I could get it out and nobody wanted to take a picture or talk to me at the time.
Yeah, yeah, and being on the first U.S. team to lose in 14 years or whatever, I mean, that's, you know, you took it tough. And,
yeah, not good. And I felt really bad for Bevo Forte because he was the team manager that year, and it's not like Bevo did anything wrong. But,
yeah.
You know, he's the team manager that lost it. You know, and so I know he takes it personal too, and we joke about it now, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't tough to swallow back then.
And in 97 when you lost, apparently just watered the crap out of the track. I mean, is that – that's not an excuse or anything, but was that all true?
Yeah. But
track prep so wasn't what? There?
Yeah, you know, yeah. It's not like we weren't all good mud riders.
Right.
You know, that was the only time that I had finished outside of a second in my class was the final moto. But once again, the first moto I should have easily won the race.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Nickel passed me and won the race. I was pretty disappointed. Lammy and Dow just had horrendous motos, you know, getting taken out and crashing and whatever happened. And that was a tough one, too, because going into the final race, I mean, we weren't in it. We were out.
Yeah.
And once again, I'm like, you got to be kidding me, you know. And this is going to ruin what is my my perfect season, you know.
And you didn't go the year before, so...
I was just telling the story just yesterday that, you know, that final moto in Belgium, I was going to show everybody who the fastest motorcycle rider in the world was.
Right?
I get the whole shot, like start to wheelie away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I took a breath the whole time. I just was so angry. And then my forearms blew up, my brain blew up, and I faded back to 11th, and I never fell.
Yeah,
and that was a pretty tough way to end the season.
That was on par with the Seattle first to 14th, I imagine, or tougher.
Yeah, it was just like that. Yeah.
What about okay? So we've covered some miserable destinations for moments for you, but what are some of the best ones?
Well, I mean the what issue is this? Volume 12, number 12?
Yeah, 12.
December 09 has got the Eric Johnson story on the 92 team.
Mm-hmm.
That was great. I really enjoyed the 93 win that we had. I especially enjoyed the track that was in Austria.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed the trip and everything that we went on. And you know, the 95 when I was teammates with Lamson and Hughes and Rhino had that really disappointing final moto where Kurt Nickel had crashed just in front of him and took him out, and he tried to battle back, and that was when I was kind of slowing the race up, and the mm-hmm. Belgians thought that I was trying to slow up so I could take out Smets, but I wasn't going to take him out. I just wanted us all to tighten up, you know,
to
give Rhino a chance because he was battling so hard. Came up short there to the Belgians, and that was a tough one to take. Not that I dislike them or anything now, but back then it was, you know, it was bitter rivals. And then to come back in 96 and to dominate the way that we did, Lamson, McGrath, myself, we just dominated our classes.
Spain, right?
Yeah, nobody had a chance, you know. The best the best memory from that day was that in the first moto, I got the whole shot on the big pig on mm-hmm. the 500 Cowie. And Tortelli was the 125 world champion, and Lamson was the AMA champion.
Right.
And I had it in my mind that if these guys got together, I was going to let them duke it out. And so I just basically pulled over, let them by, and just rode behind them and watched these guys just trade paint, you know. I wasn't really worried about anybody, anybody in my class. It seems like I had it pretty well handled, but... just watching Lamson and Tortelli go after it, and Lamson ended up getting the best of him that day. There was a lot of pride in that too, you know, a lot of that, you know, USA thing going on. So
I just, I read that. I don't have that issue yet, but I did read that story before it made the issue, and it struck me as somebody like Jeff, like Fro, you never made excuses, you never said no. You know what I mean? It was just like, let's go. Let's go to the Motocross of Nations every year, you know? And I don't know, it's got to be a sense of pride for you in your career.
Yeah, I certainly
just to go that many
appreciated
times,
it. It was the event is always something that I look forward to. And I think that we've gone through an event like that this year where, you know, some of the guys here in the U.S. didn't want to go. And I think that it was interesting reading the comments in this issue from Bradshaw and from Stanton and those guys talking about that they made the decision not to go. And Stanton's like, man, I blew it, you know.
Yeah.
I really should have gone.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's about as, you know, patriotic as, you know, as a guy gets. So, you know, fortunately, I don't have any regrets that way.
Yeah, no. When America asked, Jeff Emig answered. We could have used you on Canada, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you guys can use anybody.
Whoa. Oh, you got Dean Wilson. Wait till you get
hey,
a hold of him.
Smoking. He's gonna be awesome.
Oh, I know. All right, let's we covered your career basically. I think
finally.
I know.
Hour 48 minutes.
I know. Let's. I want to talk to you a little bit about this season coming up. I mean, as not only are you a legend in the sport, not only do you call the races, but you strike me, and I don't know you that well, but you strike me as a fan as well. And so as a fan, this Stewart-Reed rivalry has got to be pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, it certainly was heated at the end of the season last year. And I got to tell you, James looks pretty good on that new Yamaha. They are really clicking.
Isn't it funny?
Maybe the change is good for Chad, you know, getting on the Cowie. And, you know, I obviously have a great relationship with the company still, and I believe in, you know, in the race program that, that Kawasaki puts together. And sometimes a change is good. And I tell you what, though, they're going to have to get after it because the Stewart's starts are good, and his finishes are good, and the middle is good, and he's going to be tough to beat. And I was thinking about it just last week that, you know, how do you beat somebody that seems unbeatable, you know? And I've been through that.
Yeah.
And it's not easy because it took a lot of years, you know. So. Is somebody going to be able to achieve that this year? I don't know.
Reed
got have to prove it to us, you know.
Yeah, Reed got closer last year than I thought he would, and I've told him that too. I mean, he impressed me. He had something for James. You know, he couldn't cover him straight up. You know what I mean? Something had to happen. But a win is a win, and he got a few of them, and he pressured James, no doubt about that, at some races. And I think it's hilarious that 2 years later, they're on opposite teams. They've switched teams now, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of ironic, and I think it'll be pretty exciting. Do you think that those two, is the dislike real? I mean, what do you think about that? They really don't like each other, huh?
It's just, you know, it's just the competitive thing.
Mm-hmm. Just like they, what you were talking about?
They don't like how each other, you know, has gone about their business. But, I mean, would expect these guys to be best buddies right now. I just don't – it just ain't going to happen. And there's just too much on the line. There's too much at stake. You know, Chad's going to have to get out of his comfort zone. And I don't know if where he's at at this stage of his career that he's going to do that.
Right.
And, you know – He obviously has a game plan and is going to put together the best program that he can. But just from, you know, from the analyst position, I'd just like to see him, you know, just get a little crazy and just, you know, get out of that comfort zone. And, I mean, last year we were talking about quarter, second a lap, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like much, but you add up, you know, 17 races, 20 laps, you know, ends up being quite a bit.
Yeah, Chad's remarkable string of finishes is just that. It's remarkable, but at the same time, maybe you'd like to see him hang it out and take a DNF here and there from hanging it out. I mean, not a DNF, but you know what I mean.
Just, and on the flip side is that people like, everybody's always said with James, hey, just back it down a little bit, half a second a lap, just get a little more, just bring it back into the comfort zone some. But I don't think that either one of those guys, they've already established over the last decade that this is what you see is what you get. And last year, overall speed reigned supreme, and it trumped the the consistency that Chad was throwing out. So.
Right. Looking back on your career, can you specifically remember any times that you were scared on the bike, that you hung it out so much that you were scared? you know, and it got you to a new level? Like, what, you know, what could you tell Chad if he came to you and said, hey, Fro, like, you know, you talk about, you know, leaving my comfort zone. What do you mean? Give me some examples. What would you say to him?
Oh, I mean, I just never was that type of rider.
Yeah.
You have to, if I want to go faster, I have to increase the comfort zone.
Right.
So, and that's stuff that just doesn't happen overnight. You know? It's baby steps. But like I said, we're really only talking about, you know, quarter of a second, half a second. You know, getting great starts, not having any mistakes. There certainly were plenty of races last year, like at Seattle, where if Chad hadn't given up that big chunk, then the idea of being Mr. Consistent, and that's going to win the championship, it would have worked. But he wasn't as consistent as what we he wasn't, his average was not good that night. You know, he was like a seventh or something.
Excellent point. Hey, have you ever, getting on that, have you ever said something in the broadcast that pissed a rider off and came up to you next weekend or called you during the week? Because I'd like some advice on that. But
I have, and
how do you deal with that? How is that for you?
It's not, you know, you replay it, you go back and analyze it and say, okay, is what I was saying, was it true? Is it true? Was it my opinion or was it fact? You know, I try to put myself in their position, and like there was a situation in the motocross championship this year that we had to address, and I really learned something from it. I learned something about myself. I learned something about how I call the race, about what my focus needs to be and what my mindset needs to be. So, sure. I mean, not too much. I mean, nobody really says anything good or bad, you know, only if, you know, a couple of hiccups here where somebody didn't appreciate it too much.
But I don't think you're doing your job if you're not, you know, offering some honest looks at riders.
Yeah, I mean, some people think I need to be a little bit harder, be a little bit more critical on the guys. And I think as I get more comfort and more confidence in the booth, I could be that way. But I just call it how I see it, you know.
Yeah, no, I think at the end of the day, that's all you can do. And you certainly have the credentials to back up whatever you're saying, you know. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I try not to, you know. It's not about me. It's not about my career. It's about what I know and, you know, how I'm going to analyze what's going on now. And I'm real fortunate that, you know, like I said, we have a great crew that has, you know, like with our producer who basically, you know, writes the shows and comes up with the idea and the vibe for the show. Our team that puts it all together, what we come up with, I think is you know, right on par. I think that they do a great job, and it's tough to do our sport. It's tough in one aspect that we have few winners, and like this summer we had quite a few winners, and it was really exciting. But if one guy takes off with the championship and wins week after week after week, it's tough to make it exciting from a standpoint as if you're not, you know, one of our normal viewers. Okay,
right.
So you're always trying to reach new viewers. And make the shows exciting. So there's always challenges with it. But for me personally, I work with a great vocal coach. I
really?
Enjoy the work that I do with him.
Vocal coach.
And how it, you know, what sort of mindset that puts me in each and every week to get ready for the shows, you know, because, I mean, we're not curing cancer here. We're just calling dirt bike races. But
right.
for me, it's the most important thing in the world. I want to do it the best that I possibly can. Okay? And that's that. Because that's the mindset of a champion. That's what a champion does, right? No matter what you're doing. If you're flipping burgers, I'm telling you, if I was at In-N-Out, I would make you the nicest hamburger that has ever been put on a red plastic tray.
That sounds
okay?
good.
Okay? Because that's what a champion does. He builds a champion hamburger. Right?
Absolutely, Fro. I never looked at it that way. We've talked off the air, and I've told you I wish that you leaned on your racing experience more. That's just my own opinion, and certainly what you say makes perfect sense, where you're not living in the past. you know, you're going to look forward and talk about the riders on the screen, and it's not about Jeff Emig. Having said that, though, I wish sometimes you would be like, hey, I remember I T-boned McGrath, and he was met, you know, so I don't know. That's just me as a moto fan, though, you know, and I see your points, though.
I think it's just, I think it's a confidence thing that, you know, if I feel confident talking about that stuff, or if it you know, specifically relates to something that has happened or a situation. I mean, I have in the past, but I don't like to go there too much. I keep it pretty current.
Yeah, no, I know that. Hey, let me. You don't have to go here if you don't want to, but I heard there was an altercation or some words between you and Jason Lawrence one time after a race at a bar or at a hotel or something. And I don't know, I heard that maybe you weren't along on the best of terms with him, but if you could, or have you spoken to him about anything, or have you ever offered advice, or what's that relationship like?
Well, sure. I mean, the year before that, Sepkovic kept calling me about coaching Jason.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like I was going to be his trainer.
Yeah.
It was just going to be his coach and his life coach. And it was something that I wasn't interested in. Finally, it made sense. We spent a very short time together. It didn't work out. He wasn't ready to make the changes. It wasn't jiving with what I was, my plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got really bad, because here I'm like, man, I'm trying to help you. And there was a situation one night that just wasn't so good. And, you know, I was, you know, I just got, really offended that, guys like him and Hansen, they were calling me out on stuff. And I'm going, man, here you guys are telling me in one breath that I was your favorite rider, and then the next minute, you know, you guys are wanting to gang up on me. And it's like,
yeah.
I would have never done that to Brock Glover or Rick Johnson or somebody, you know. I mean, I'm like, wow, that's not very respectful when I'm trying to help you. And if you, you know, if you guys have so much respect for me, what I did as a racer or whatever, then why aren't you listening?
Yeah.
I mean,
sort of why I brought that up.
Guys, I had the same guys calling me back in the day, okay, the guys before me, because they see it much clearer than what you do when you're in the moment. And my hope for Jason, just like it is, you know, for Josh Hansen right now, is that those guys get it figured out, because they have incredible opportunities, and both riders, I mean, extremely talented.
Yeah.
And hopefully this situation that Jason Lawrence is going through, that he's going to learn something from it, accept his mistakes, you know, and make some changes, because that's all we really want. That's the real hope. That was the attraction with all of my fan base around the time of of the U.S. Open. They wanted the underdog to win.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. It was hugely popular.
Fans
win.
Love it.
Yes.
The human nature, we love that shit.
Yeah.
And if Jason Lawrence is able to realize and actually, you know, do the work that's involved to make a better life for himself, then, you know, a couple years from now, we could have some really great things to say about him. And that's really the only hope, is that 10 years from now, you know, he's not, you know,
right,
in a big dark hole somewhere, you know, with a bunch of regrets.
Now, I mean, obviously he doesn't have nearly the race wins and titles that you have, so maybe this is a dumb question, but is he the Jeff Emig of 98? I mean, no.
The Jason Lawrence of 2008, 2009.
We're all individual.
I mean, certainly there was the Weinert in the 90s and Lachine in the 80s and me in the...
Yeah.
Or, wait, Weinert
in the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you could call it that. It seems to fit the decades, but...
You know, I know you have a hell of a lot of race wins and titles to back up, you know, where Jason has an East Coast title, but I don't know, just when you brought up his name earlier and then you started telling me about how, you know, you got help for yourself, and I'm like, I know you'd offered Jason some help, and I'm like, man, if only you could listen to Fro, because Fro's been at the top, he's been at the bottom, he's been in the middle, you know?
Yeah, but so, if you ain't ready, you ain't ready. It's all up to, all up to the individual, and thankfully,
good point.
I was ready. I wanted to make a change. I wanted something better in my life, and so now, you know, I'm a husband. I have two wonderful children.
professional career is going well?
Yeah, yeah, I've got a lot of irons in the fire, a lot of interesting, exciting things in my life. So, I mean, I'm fortunate that I had the racing career that I did, and that I have an industry that I love being around. I love the people that I associate with in all the different facets, and it's a pretty cool industry, and that's why I'm not going anywhere.
I can't find too many people, really anybody, to say a bad word about Jeff Emig, and I think that says something.
They're out there, don't worry.
Really? I don't know.
Yeah, you just got to hit the numbers.
I'm going to try. I'm going to ask around, but seriously, I mean, you know, when you say like, hey, yeah, Fro's...
If it was 1 in 100, you've probably been through 99 now, and that last one is going to
No, no, I think you're I think you're universally loved, to me anyways, I think, as a rider, as a person, you know, as a champion and all that, so...
Interesting. There's certainly situations out there that I'm not too proud of, and things that I've done in my life or how I've treated people at times, you know, probably wouldn't appreciate if that was, if somebody had treated me that way. But,
right. You
know, you try to learn from your mistakes, and you move on, and you try to mature, and you try to learn and get better, do things right. So, but certainly there's... speed bumps along the way, and I've hit a couple, but I like where I'm at right now.
Yeah, well said. Anything you want to pump up on this podcast? You know, anything you want to talk about? Anything going on that you want to publicize? I don't even know. But.
Not specifically. Other than that, if all you guys could go out and grab some of my old teammate Ryan Hughes, go on his Rhino Organics website and grab some of. Some of the delicious organic fruits and nuts that he has, that would be cool.
There you go. And all this time, I just thought Rhino ate raw meat from animals he freshly choked.
He does.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be organic, an organic animal, though.
Whatever. Joke lost me. Well, cool, Fro. Thank you for doing this. Part two of the Racer X podcast show, and... if you add these two together, you've gone longer than Wardy, and it's a new record. But
I appreciate everybody listening. I know this has been probably upwards of 2 hours if you put them both together, and glad that there's this outlet and that you that the fans are listening and are interested in our stories. So
yeah,
and certainly see everybody back again at Anaheim 1. I can't wait. It's gonna be great.
Right on, Fro. Well, thank you for doing the Racer X podcast.
All right, take care.
See you.
This has been the Racer X Podcast Show with Steve Mathis. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows with motocross legends such as The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Lachine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse, and, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course, everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled pick and I left. Every point count. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
VO Show. Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you sit there, you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Subscribe to the Racer X Podcast Show through iTunes to enjoy these and many more great podcasts. And why can't I just try? You know,